Let me introduce you to Ashmit Sidana, founder and managing partner of Engineering Capital. Ashmit is currently a VC entrepreneur. He has just started this new fund, and he's going to tell us about what he sees as the changes in the venture capital industry. So as entrepreneurs, just like we are constantly navigating the technology trends and what's happening on the technology side of the industry or on the business side of the industry, on the market side of the industry, we also need to understand what's happening on the financing side of the industry. So I invited Ashmit, who is an incredibly thoughtful person, to share with us his observations about what's happening on the venture capital side. Ashmit, welcome. We're very pleased to have you here, and thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Samana. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm wondering if, since this is the last session for the year, whether you've saved the best for last.
Yes, I'm sure I have. So Ashmit, you come from a traditional venture capital background. Of course, you come from a very heavy-duty technology background, and then you made a stop in the traditional venture capital industry. Tell us, what is your observation or analysis of the venture business today?
Well, overall, I would say the venture business is thriving. There's been a banner year for distributions this year. LPs are very happy. It's been a banner year for fundraising, lots of new capital coming in, and most importantly, lots of new companies being created. So innovation is active, funding is active, exits are active, and so overall the business is thriving. There are some underlying changes which we can get into structurally, and why I'm an entrepreneur now in the venture business and some of the changes which we are seeing, two of which the most important which get talked about are, one, the reduction in capital to start a company, the so-called lean startup movement, the fact that you can start very quickly, but also the total amount of capital which it takes to build a company to success and exit. You know, we hear about $500 million and billion-dollar rounds. And so it's really these two trends which seemingly seem to contradict each other that is reshaping the venture industry.
So let's double-click down on these two trends. Of course, our audience is very familiar with both trends, actually, because we cover both trends extensively. But let's analyze those. The lean startup movement is something that is very core to our world. You know, we operate in the very early stages of the entrepreneurship life cycle, and we propagate the message of lean startup and capital efficient bootstrap startups very, very aggressively. So how does that impact the venture capital industry today?
I think the biggest change lean startups have brought into the industry is the success and the creation of seed funds. I myself run a seed fund. Engineering Capital is focused on the seed stage. Because it takes a small amount of capital to get a company started, prove product market fit, that's really what is the lean startup movement is about. I'm very proud to share with you that Steve Blank, who is one of the key thinkers in this, you could argue is the founder of the lean startup movement, is an advisor and an investor of Engineering Capital. And so we've thought very carefully about what will be the impact of lean startups, where will it grow. And it's this ability to start a company quickly, iterate quickly, get product market fit, which is the heart of the lean startup movement. What is interesting about Engineering Capital in particular is that we are focused on the infrastructure side. The lean startup movement got a lot of publicity and press on the consumer side, and people talk about writing iPhone applications or perhaps even building, you know, Web 2.0 or mobile applications in the lean format. What is interesting that I am seeing now is that on core technology, hardcore infrastructure, we are seeing lean technologies get applied.
So now, one trend that we see is that even the seed funds or even angel investors these days expect that entrepreneurs are going to bootstrap ahead of time before they actually come to raise the seed capital. So there is this whole pre-seed activity of validation, of seeking product market fit, and then even the earliest stage investors are looking for businesses to invest in that have already achieved product market fit. Can you comment on that?
Sure. This is actually not a new trend. It has always been true that, you know, every investor wants to see as much progress as possible before they come in. Of course, the more the progress, the more ahead they are, the lower the risk in the investment. And so investors have always wanted to see it. However, depending on the state of the market, you know, whether the market is bullish or ebullient like it is right now, you know, you'll perhaps see people take more risk. When times are tough, cash is tight, you'll see people take fewer risk and they want to see more progress in front. So this is not a new trend. We've seen it before. The important thing to keep in mind is that building a startup is an evolution that occurs from the concept of an idea. When a person wakes up one day and says, I'm going to start a company, all the way to when they have revenues, perhaps they go public, perhaps they get sold, and at some point they leave that company, which can be a journey of 5, 10, 15, or 50 years in some case. And so financings are simply events along that journey, and they are really the side effect of that journey. And so starting with the core issue, what's the company I'm building, what's the business I'm going to grow, what change am I going to create in the world, and then you do financing events along the way, and yes, there's a seed financing, perhaps there's a Series A, Series B, there's debt and equity which you raise along the ways. Even an IPO is just a financing event. All the great entrepreneurs, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Page, Steve Jobs, they continue to run their companies well after even the IPO.
So the other side of this coin is this whole, you know, explosion in capital in the late stage financing, and on very unreasonable terms, on very unreasonable fundamentals, and you know, I personally believe that that trend is going to slow down next year, just because a lot of these companies that have bloated valuations and weak fundamentals are going to kind of implode in the public market, and we are seeing a lot of that happening already. You know, I just started writing a series called From Unicorn to Unicorp, and we covered a couple of companies already that are going through this, you know, rather painful process. Now, what is your analysis of why this tendency of funding non-fundamentally sound companies at such heavy levels happening? We've seen this before. It happened in the dot-com era. It's happening again. Have we not learned anything?
Well, there are two different things which happened in the dot-com era in the way in which things are different right now. But first, let me agree with you that there are companies which have raised money at very high valuations on very poor fundamentals, and so we will see unicorpses. I love that word. So we will certainly see some failures which will happen over there, but conversely, we will also see successes. There are companies, I mean, Facebook was arguably a company that people thought was overvalued all along the way, but it has proved
to be a
sustainable
long-term business. It was overvalued, but it never lacked fundamentals, though. It always had very good, good fundamentals.
It had very good fundamentals in terms of user traction, but it didn't have any revenues, it didn't have any profits.
No, it had revenues, it had good revenues.
No, I'm talking in the much earlier days, when I'm talking about at the 1 billion mark and the 10 billion mark, when valuations were done, which were pre-revenue valuations for
Facebook. Those were not pre-revenue valuations, not on Facebook. No, Facebook aside, but this... I just wrote a piece, actually. I went through all the numbers on Facebook. You can look it up on my, you know, on my blog and on LinkedIn. But Facebook aside, there are a lot of companies who are getting these ridiculous valuations with no fundamentals. So what is going on?
I agree with you on the basic point that there are companies which have unsustainable businesses, so to speak, businesses in quotes, which have raised money at very high valuations, and let's call a spade a spade. A company that I worry a lot about, for example, is Dropbox. I don't understand the sustainable competitive differentiation that Dropbox has. Why is this company valued so highly? We can argue that that's probably not a good idea. We may be proved wrong. These things can change. But today, based on the little bit that I know about Dropbox, I worry about the valuation it has. But let's understand the underlying trend. Why did so much money come into late-stage valuations in these companies? This was driven by two underlying forces. One, because of regulatory and market changes in the U.S., it became less attractive for for CEOs to take companies public. Basically, we have raised the bar so high on regulatory compliance, partly as a reaction to Enron and some of the bad behavior that occurred after the dot-com, during and after the dot-com boom, that now it's very unattractive to run a public company. I serve on many boards, I have CEOs, I talk to them all the time, and they're like, I don't want to deal with I don't want to run a public company, I don't want to be on a public board. It's just really, really hard. So one is this raising of the pain threshold that I think has gone too far from the government side. Because of that, companies moved, it became much less attractive, and so people started looking for sources of private capital. Coincidentally, at the same time, we had a big financial crash, interest rates came down to zero. There's a lot of capital, and the Federal Reserve and all the other central banks flooded the market with capital. So there's an enormous amount of capital which is available now, which has to go and find yield. Interest rates are effectively zero, barring the small raise last night from the Federal Reserve. And so there's a lot of money chasing yield. And the only place where yield was available, since you couldn't do it in bonds, you couldn't do it in fixed income, you couldn't do it in all the traditional asset classes, it started coming into private companies. And that is why these two things coming together is what created what you could argue is a bubble or this very late stage frothy market which we've seen, where there will be some irrational behavior that will occur.
But you know, the truth is though, public market is not in a bubble, right? The public market actually is reasonably sane these days. And most of these companies who are getting this ridiculous private market valuations would not be able to go public because they don't have the numbers, the fundamentals to go public.
And that is bad behavior. So
right?
I agree completely. That is the case. That is happening in certain cases. It's a case-by-case basis. There are also great companies which get created. And again, as an entrepreneur, what we have to keep in mind is markets come and markets go. It's a cyclic, the markets are always cyclic, economies are always cyclic, businesses don't have to be cyclic. If you can build a company which has true technology innovation, which has a true sustainable barrier to entry and a competitive advantage, where you are creating value for people, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the markets are, it doesn't matter how what the regulatory environment is, you can succeed if you have those core ingredients. And what I'm very excited about is the change and the innovation which I have been seeing in the data center space, in the cloud space, in the infrastructure space. That change is so dramatic, and there is such a large disruption which is about to occur over there, which is why I started my firm and obviously I'm focused on that space.
So we want to talk about that in a lot more depth. I just want to underscore what you just said with one point for our audience. You know, I was recently in Europe, and in Vienna I went to see a performance of Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion. And I don't know how many of you are intimately familiar with Pygmalion. There is a point where this dustman who is given a who makes no money, he's very poor, and he's kind of poor and free. He has this great off-the-wall philosophy of life, very cavalier, and he drinks and he does whatever he wants. And then suddenly, he has been given this 3,000-pound stipend, and he has to be, he's intimidated. He cannot refuse this money, even though he loses his freedom in the process. And there are these great lines that Bernard Shaw delivers through him about that process of somebody losing his freedom to middle-class morality, as he calls it. Now, the reason I bring this example up is many entrepreneurs in our world are being offered irrational amounts of money. And most first-time entrepreneurs especially, even latest, serial entrepreneurs, don't have the, they get intimidated by those huge sums of money being offered and they lose their head. You need a very serious level of internal compass, seriously strong level of internal compass to be able to withstand and turn down these kinds of overtures, which are actually in the long run not healthy for you. Now, if you actually, Maureen, I think has shared my very recent Facebook post how did Mark Zuckerberg retain 26% equity in Facebook after raising so much money? Take a look at that and take a look at how much money was being thrown at Zuckerberg and how he managed to navigate through that. And I just, you know, recently, because in the process of writing this post, I went through every single round of financing, and there is, for somebody so young, there's a tremendous amount of steadiness in how he has navigated through that, and there's something to learn from that. So if you are faced with this scenario where you don't really have the fundamentals to support the kind of funding that you are being offered, and you are losing control of the destiny of the company through rounds of financing that are unreasonable, please pause. It is okay to turn down huge amounts of money and work within reason, and your chances of success are actually going to be a lot higher if you act with some discretion in those circumstances. We know of some entrepreneurs who have been associated with our program who are going through this process of huge amounts of money being thrown at them, and they're not able to keep their heads really cool. All right.
Samana, there's a great wisdom in what you're saying. If I may add to what you're saying, that it is not only it is not only something that entrepreneurs should think about doing. I would say that you are required to say no to money on the path to success. Every company which is successful at some point says no to large amounts of money along the way. And here's the way I visualize it with my CEOs. What I tell them is, you're running a marathon. Any money you raise is candy. The real thing that you want is whole wheat bread, lots of you know, protein. That's how you run marathons. You don't run marathons by eating candy. Raising money is candy. Where is the protein? Where is the whole wheat? That is revenues and profits.
Yes.
That's what you have to go and get. So that is the analogy that I always make. Completely agree with you. And I haven't seen Pygmalion, but the wisdom of middle class morality was brought to me by the Hollywood version of that, which is the movie My Fair Lady, where I think it's Rex Harrison who delivers the money to this this artist, and then you get this this feedback. Completely agree with the wisdom of what you're saying.
So I'm going to use your analogy. I love the analogy of protein and whole wheat bread versus this candy. You know, our line on that is entrepreneurship equals customers, revenues, and profits. Financing is optional. Exit is optional. So perfect. Ashmit, tell us about Engineering Capital and the core focus that you've chosen, and what are the trends, what are you seeing, and what are the discontinuities that you think are going to yield great companies in the infrastructure space?
Thank you, Shramana. There's a lot of disruptions happening right now in the mobile space, in the consumer space, in the finance space. I happen to be focused on a very different disruption, which I noticed about 2 years ago, which started with a very simple observation, which is that if you walk into the best data centers in the world today, the types of data centers that are run by Facebook, Google, Amazon, you will find that there are no servers from HP, IBM, or Dell. There are no switches from Cisco or Juniper. There is no storage from EMC or NetApp. There are no operating systems from Microsoft or VMware in any of these data centers. And I can go on and on naming well-known, excellent, successful technology companies that appear to be the leaders in their space, which don't provide any of the technology to these fabulous data centers. And so these excellent, wonderful new data centers are more efficient, cheaper, faster. And so it was inevitable that there will be a large disruption which will happen, and that's the space that I have been investing in. I think new companies will be created over here. They will be created in the security space, in the monitoring and management space, in the storage space, and even in the core compute space. And so I look at all of them. These tend to be very technical companies. Obviously, they must have a deep technical component, but also real business models, and that's what I look for.
Ashmit, can you give us a couple of examples of companies that you've invested in, and also walk us through the investment thesis of why you chose to invest in those companies? I'd like our audience to learn how you evaluate companies.
Sure. So let's start with an example. One of my portfolio companies is Menlo Security. Menlo Security was started by Amir Benafram and Purnima. Amir was a vice president at Juniper who was a successful entrepreneur who had previously done a company called Altor Networks. And mm-hmm. he had the observation that endpoint security is fundamentally broken. We have been selling antivirus. Everybody installs antivirus on their desktops, and it really hasn't solved the problem. We still have breaches. We still have people, hackers breaking in. And so there was a fundamental new approach needed to solve this problem. He worked with Professor Song from Berkeley, and they came up with a fundamental new approach where we actually take all traffic coming in from the internet, whether it's web, whether it's email, and all of it runs in the cloud, and there is only a display version of that which is provided to the desktop, to the end customer. So this is targeted only at large enterprises today. Eventually, we think we will also go after the consumer market. But it 100% guarantees that there cannot be a breach on your desktop in an enterprise because we never let anything run on the desktop. There is no JavaScript, there is no Java, there is no endpoint code, there's nothing running on the endpoint. And so it's a very successful company. I was a seed investor in them, raised a modest amount of money, used the lean startup approach, got to some product market fit very quickly on that money, then raised a Series A from General Catalyst, and then Sutter Hill Ventures, and so, you know, continues to grow and build a really large business now.
And this company is selling to enterprises?
Yes. Menlo Security today is focused primarily on large enterprises. So if you're a bank, if you're a financial services enterprise, that is our target market. You have to be very, very careful what you do. And yet you have tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands of employees who have to run desktops, who have to be able to interact with the web, who have to, of course, work with email. There is no modern business that can run without access to the web or to email. And yet antivirus was not solving the problem. So a radical new technology with a fundamentally new architecture, creating real business value in what we've been able to create with Menlo Security. Real credit to Amir, Purnima, and the rest of the team there.
And are all your investments in engineering capital focused on enterprise-facing businesses?
They don't have to be. That is the case right now. Really, engineering capital will invest in a great entrepreneur with a great technical idea who can fundamentally disrupt the infrastructure space. That's what I'm looking for. If you have a credible business plan, I'm interested in you. And for me, credible business plans have a path to profits. So whether that profit comes because you sell to a consumer or an enterprise, both are valid approaches, and I'm open to either.
Okay. Why don't we do one more example from your portfolio, and then we'll switch to the other next topic.
Sure. So another investment I have is in a company called Zockets. This is a very, very technical play. It is a new memory architecture, and what it lets you do is run Hadoop or Spark or Tez or any of these big data platforms up to 100 times faster. Fundamental innovation, still at the seed stage. I recently invested in the company, we still have technical risk, so we haven't yet proved that this will work, but if it does work, I think it will radically change how people run big data workloads.
And what are you looking for in the founders that you choose to invest in?
That is my favorite topic because it is the most important thing, especially working at the seed stage where the market is still unproven, the technology is still unproven. Often we don't even have a clear idea of exactly what the product will be when I'm investing over there. So it really is about the founders. It really is about the team that makes the difference. I continue to believe that Apple would not exist without Steve Jobs, Microsoft would not exist without Bill Gates, Facebook would not exist without Mark Zuckerberg, Oracle would not exist without Larry Ellison, and Hewlett and Packard would not have existed without Dave and Bill. And so it really is about the founders, and what is it that makes these people so special, and what do I look for? First, I look for the fundamentals. Are they intelligent? Are they hardworking? Perhaps they have a good education, not required, but useful to have. Do they have good work habits? Are they ambitious? Are they motivated? These are basic skills If you don't have these skills, I don't think you can succeed as an entrepreneur. But the reality is a large number of people have these skills and yet don't succeed. So what is the additional component that makes an entrepreneur successful? Here are some of the attributes. Great entrepreneurs have the ability to have a big vision, to dream, think big, see the future before other people can, and then bring it and relate it all the way back to reality today. If you can only dream big dreams, perhaps you're hallucinating. You are not a great entrepreneur. If you are only in the weeds and looking at the details, then you can't have the big vision. You need to be able to do both. Great entrepreneurs also have contradictory attributes. They are incredibly persistent. They are incredibly diligent. They can take many, many no's and continue to move forward with their own vision. Yet, they are also great listeners. They know when to understand what a customer wants, what users want, and how to change what they're doing. We talked about Facebook earlier. Look how much it has changed over the years. It started as an application on universities. Look at where Facebook is today. What does it do? It has iterated all along the way at a very rapid pace. Great entrepreneurs have the ability to change path just like this. Microsoft started as a compiler company, became an operating system company, and really became a productivity company after that. Great entrepreneurs have the ability to make this change while facing criticism and negative feedback from people saying that what they're dreaming about is not possible. And so looking for these contradictory attributes is essential.
And as a VC, how do you figure these things out? These are not easy to figure out.
My answer to that is that this comes from good judgment, and good judgment comes from bad experiences. So you have to work hard. You have to try things. As you can see over here, I have no shortage of gray hair. Some of these have come from having done well, but some of them have also come from making mistakes. And so it really comes from that, and I don't think we have yet distilled this into a formula or a method. I can tell you that you can spend an hour with a person and walk away with a deep impression of, is this person truly motivated, or perhaps they're just interested in status. You know, you talk to a person who wants to be a CEO because they're interested in status, and you want to talk to a CEO who wants to change the world, and you want to talk to a CEO who wants to make other people successful. Three very different views why you meet people who pursue that path. So that's what you look for. It comes from experience. I've actually just come back from a machine learning conference. I continue to be astounded at the amount of progress that machine learning is making and some of these new approaches we are seeing in HR and people management. You know, Google is very active. Netflix has a very different approach in how they manage people. And so I think eventually this will get automated, but for now it's just judgment, and it's really just experience.
You know, one of my observations about the world, about society in general, is that authenticity is rare. The world is actually dominated by hypocrisy. So now, as a VC, you're going to need to figure out how much of the what the person is telling you is selling and pitching and the surface stuff versus what really is inside. And that's not an easy thing to do in short amounts of time.
It's not easy, but it's also not hard. You know, companies do it all the time. They just do it at different levels. When a president appoints his cabinet, and when a president, picks the Secretary of State, they're making the same decision. They're making a hiring decision. They're making a judgment call.
And they're making spectacularly bad decisions, I think, on a continuous basis.
Because it is hard, right?
Because it is hard.
Right.
I mean, look at the horse circus going on at Yahoo over and over and over again. This is like, this company cannot find a CEO who works.
You're absolutely right. It's a very hard business. It is an error-prone business. That is why VCs, politicians, CEOs, everybody makes mistakes when they do it. Even mafia dons make mistakes. Even they go through recruiting decisions when they hire people. But it's okay to fail as long as you're clear about the goal and you can iterate towards success. A great example for that is Abraham Lincoln. He was president. He was fighting a civil war. He went through many generals. He had to choose general after general after general. So it is a great skill to be able to hire people and find the right person for the right fit. Take another example of a great recruiting decision that was made. We have a president in Second World War who has to choose who is going to be the commander for the entire Allied forces. Okay, you know who I'm talking about, Eisenhower, a person who eventually went on to become a president himself. Eisenhower was not next in line to be promoted. It was a controversial decision, but what a great decision, right? So these decisions have been made through history by people in different contexts, whether it's war, politics, business, recruiting. The rules are the same. We are recruiting people, we are working with people, building teams. Right now, I can say it comes from judgment, it comes from experience. You know, I've interviewed hundreds, probably thousands of people, over the years for jobs, and I've made my share of mistakes. I've had to fire people. So this is not a error-free process, but you spend some time, you learn about people, and you can come to some good judgment about it.